You remain standing for the reading of the Word of God. It comes to us once again from Matthew chapter 5. This morning we begin in verse 33. Again, that you have heard that it was said to those of ancient times, "You shall not swear falsely, but carry out the vows you have made to the Lord." But I say to you, do not swear at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. And do not swear by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. Let your word be yes, yes, or no, no. Anything more than this comes from the evil one. It's the word of God for the people of God.
Thanks be to God.
You may be seated. Now, some of you may have had this experience. I never have had this experience. I have never been sworn in as a witness in a courtroom. I mean, it seems an odd thing, anyway, that you have to swear an oath to tell the truth. And nothing but the truth, so help you God. I don't think you have to say the "so help me God" part anymore. As if God's going to help you tell the truth if you're not going to anyway. And I'm sure you don't have to put your hand on the Bible anymore like this when you swear to tell the truth and the whole truth and nothing but the truth. And I guess that makes sense because to do so assumes that it's supposed to carry some extra weight of accountability or responsibility if I do that. And why would it? I mean, especially if someone does that who doesn't believe in the Bible or the God of the Bible. But I did read somewhere that if you aren't sworn in and take an oath to tell the truth, you aren't considered competent to testify, which seems to make the assumption that people can't be trusted to be truthful. In fact, it sounds to me like it defaults to the idea that we aren't truthful, particularly when it comes to our own self-interest. And therefore, we have to be made to be truthful under the threat of perjury or lying under oath. But I wonder, how is that different from lying not under oath? Right? They're both still lying, right? It makes it almost sound like it's okay to lie as long as you didn't take an oath that you weren't going to. I also read that children don't have to take an oath or be sworn in as long as the court ensures that the child understands the importance of telling the truth. And I also read that the court can't make you swear an oath if you refuse on religious grounds. I assume meaning if you claim to be a follower of Jesus who is living out Jesus' instructions in the Sermon on the Mount. In particular, this passage from Matthew 5, 33 to 37 that we just read. I read somewhere that Quakers have historically been known to do that. And I guess reading this passage, you could make the case that all disciples of Jesus should take that position. So the question for us means, what does Jesus mean here? And in particular, the question is always, how does this apply to us today? To begin with, remember we said earlier, we've been saying this, that Jesus didn't come to throw out the law. Rather, he came to teach his followers how to obey the law. Now, the scribes and the Pharisees apparently had come up with all kinds of laws about swearing oaths and what you could do and what you couldn't do. And since Jesus didn't come to throw out the law, it seems to me the law Jesus thought was at stake here was commandment number 3. Thou shalt not take the Lord thy God's name in vain. Or sometimes translated, you shall not make wrongful use of the name of the Lord your God. It's a commandment God takes so serious that he adds to it, I will not acquit anyone who misuses my name. Interesting that he uses trial language here. As far as Jesus was concerned, to swear on heaven or on earth or Jerusalem were all veiled attempts of swearing an oath on the name of God. And it seems pretty clear here that swearing an oath that's going to put God's reputation or God's integrity at stake in my actions is a bad thing. Maybe even, he says, an evil thing. But now, Jesus didn't just make this up or come up with it on his own. Leviticus 19:12, a long time before Jesus, God says, don't swear by my name falsely and thus profane the name of your God. In other words, we take an oath in God's name. We don't live that out. We have degraded the name and the reputation, the character of God. And we have to understand the world in which Jesus lived was one in which people believed that an oath confirmed something that was said, and it put an end to any dispute about it. In a sense, I guess we do that in court, don't we? People take an oath, and if whatever they say has to be taken as the truth, even if it's not. If someone swore an oath in Jesus' day, you could believe them because they were bound by it. Now, I'm not sure we live in that world anymore. Today, we assure our keeping our word by things like contracts. But it seems what Jesus meant was it really should be our integrity and our character that binds us to truthfulness in our speech and honesty in dealing with people. In other words, our yes should just be yes. And our no should just be no. And people should be able to count on that. And if we're people of integrity, there should be a consistency between our word and our life. And that would bring its own trustworthy reputation to us. And we wouldn't need to drag God's name into it, because my word could stand for itself. And while we don't really put all that much stock these days into swearing an oath in God's name, we do find that occasionally you hear people sort of fall back on it in desperation, you know, saying something like, "I swear to God I didn't do it," or "with God as my witness, I'm going to do this." So we still do it occasionally. And possibly even bigger problem with swearing an oath in God's name is not just that it puts God's reputation at stake, but possibly the real problem is the very act of doing it is manipulative. I mean, think about it as an attempt to get my own way by overriding people's judgment and people's will rather than respecting it and leaving it up to them, the decision whether or not to trust me and whether or not I'd proven myself as a trustworthy person. Maybe the real problem for Jesus is the manipulation of people is wrong, and it raises the larger issues of my integrity and my respect for other people. And while I don't think what I'm about to talk about is the kind of thing that's really consciously thought of as being manipulative, and really, most people may even think this is an act of honoring God, and it could be. But even the use of certain religious names for businesses, for instance, or Christian symbols that are attached to businesses could be questionable in this thing. I mean, in the way that it projects a message that says, this person is a Christian, therefore, you can trust them more than other people in the same business who don't portray themselves as a Christian. Now, things like, and I'm just making these up now, things like Trinity Plumbing or The Master's Carpentry. Now, I have to ask myself, honestly, things like, what is the purpose that I maybe put my Bible on my desk where I meet with clients, or I put a cross on my logo or on my business card or wherever? Now, all of those things could be ways of honoring God. They can be ways of witnessing to my faith. They can be ways of holding myself to an increased accountability because I'm publicly bearing His name now. But then again, they might fall into the same category as naming my business something like Honest Bob's Used Cars. You know, no offense that you're in the used car business, but I just remember that movie with Kurt Russell, you know, Used Cars, you remember that? We preachers are not exempt from this either. In fact, we probably have to be more careful about this than anybody. In fact, we may be the most guilty of this. You know, it's like if I make sure people know I'm a poor preacher, so maybe they'll cut me some slack in what they charge me. That's manipulative too, don't you think? And most likely that's a misuse of God's name and maybe even a violation of commandment number 3. It's also why I don't tell most people I play golf with that I'm a pastor, because I sure don't want God's reputation tied into my behavior on a golf course. And in moments of desperation, when I've got an 8-footer to win the money, I really have to resist the urge to make a vow to God that says, God, if you'll just let me make this putt, I'll put all that money in the offering plate. But all jokes aside, letting your yes be yes and your no be no, it is a call for followers of Jesus to live with the highest integrity. Jesus had a particular problem with the Pharisees, who he often criticized as hypocrites. It's why he told people, it's okay to do what they say, but don't do what they do. Trust is essential for influence. Remember we looked earlier that Jesus called us to be salt and light. And if we're going to be that, our character is critical. And so anything more than simply standing on our integrity and our character, Jesus said, comes from the evil one. And what he meant by that is Satan is a liar and the father of all lies, is how he describes him. He is the master manipulator. And if we fall into this trap, maybe we become a part of that same kind of manipulative work. All this did make me ask the question about the one vow that I administer often that asks people to swear an oath in God's name. Many of you have done it. I have too. When I did it, it went like this. In the name of God, I Ben take you, Susan, to be my wife, to have and to hold from this day forward, for better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, in sickness and in health, to love and to cherish, until we are parted by death. Now you find that oath in a service of Christian marriage in the back of our hymnal. And what it means is not just that I am now accountable to God for keeping that vow, but it also means that I've just drug God's reputation for unconditional love and faithfulness into my marriage and into the way I live in it. I guess it's why Roman Catholics say marriage is a sacrament, a physical symbol of the love of God for us, what it looks like. And maybe it's also why Jesus puts his teachings about character and integrity and swearing oaths right after a couple of short verses where he talks about marriage and divorce. And why he put the part about marriage and divorce right after the part that we looked at about anger and contempt and lust. Most of the time, when marriages end, it probably falls somewhere in that realm. You also might have noticed that after talking about lust that's the same as adultery, and the passage about swearing vows in the name of God and being people who can be trusted to keep their word, that I skipped those two verses on marriage and divorce. And I guess I did it because the reality is it is prevalent and painful among Christians and non-Christians. And I want worship to be a time of healing, not hurting. Or maybe because it's a really difficult passage with a whole lot of cultural nuances. Or maybe because I think there are some topics that are best discussed. And on Sunday morning, when I preach, I am the only one with a microphone. It's not a discussion. But because it is tied to today's topic, in just a word, I'd remind you that in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus is speaking to a group of men in a very patriarchal culture, where women have no power and are absolutely at the mercy of their husbands. And he's addressing the issue of the law that Moses gave them that they could have a right to divorce their wives for any reason, as long as they gave them what he called a certificate of divorce, which in reality did absolutely nothing for that woman, except possibly keeping her from being stoned for adultery if she managed to find another relationship. In other words, Jesus is once again calling his followers to something higher than the law. He's calling them to try to live into what is God's will. That marriage is a covenant relationship, a sacred trust. So he calls these men to faithfulness to their wives, and he warns them about things like contempt and anger and lust, and about integrity and keeping their word. Once again, Jesus is not trying to make a new law about marriage and divorce. In fact, if you read over in chapter 19, he talks about it a little more. And what he says at the end of it is, for those who can accept this, I offer you this, implying that there are some who can't accept that. He's simply trying to make us once again into the kind of people through whom the kingdom of heaven is coming to earth, who live within what God's will would be for us, which of course would be faithful covenant marriage that sustains itself all through life. But back to this warning about using or misusing the name of God to enhance my reputation or to manipulate people with some kind of unearned trust. We live in a culture where we work really hard on what we might call impression management, where impressing people is really important. Social media these days becomes an avenue for creating an image for ourselves. There are people called spin doctors that are hired to manipulate people's opinions, to rescue people's failed reputations. On the other hand, we have before us things like online reviews, right? They give people a place to fairly or often unfairly make or break someone's reputation or that of their business. In fact, there are even companies out there that you can hire to defend your reputation from such things. And while Jesus and his followers did not live in a world like ours of such incredible visibility and instant information, the truth that Jesus is teaching us here is timeless and cuts across every culture, because there will never, ever be a substitute for character and integrity, for doing what we say and saying what we do, where our yes just means yes and our no just means no. You might remember Jesus saying something like, "Listen, if you don't believe me for what I say, at least believe me on the basis of what you see me do." Remember, Jesus is interested in making his followers into certain kinds of people. The kind of people who aren't merely trying to conform to the law outwardly, meeting some minimum requirement to be acceptable to God, but people who are aiming for something higher than that. People who are being transformed inwardly and from whose lives naturally flow the moral law of the kingdom of heaven, and bring that to earth for others to see. And here Jesus reminds them, and he reminds us, there are no shortcuts to character and to trust. To try to find them is only evidence that we lack them. And this is the kind of thing that really is easy to overlook in our lives. It takes a particular amount of humility and healthy self-examination to see how I might easily cover up some manipulative self-interest and pass it off, even as something like an act of faith. So I'm looking all the time to how it is that I'm trying to take shortcuts to success. And maybe I'm also asking if what other people think of me is more important than what God knows about me. If I get to that place, I'm in trouble. So as Jesus put it simply, let your yes be yes and let your no be no. Live a life that generates its own trust and its own respect. And God will be most honored when we simply do that. Amen.